Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of ID the Future. This is Logan Gage for the Center for Science and Culture out in Washington, D.C., and today we have with us Dr. Richard Weikart. And Richard is the professor of history at California State University, and it's Stanislaus. And Richard's specialty is modern European history, and specifically modern German history. And so welcome to the program. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, great. Now, many of our listeners will know that you're the author of From Darwin to Hitler. And now you have a new book coming out, which is called Hitler's Ethic, The Nazi Pursuit of Evolutionary Progress. And this one's also with Palgrave Macmillan. And so to set the stage for this new book, Hitler's Ethic, why don't you give us an idea of the thesis of From Darwin to Hitler and how maybe this sets the stage for your new work?
Well, yeah, let me say just a little bit about how I came to do From Darwin to Hitler. So I think that'll give a good bit of light on what I showed in my book. I began the project trying to do some research on evolutionary ethics in late 19th century and early 20th century Germany. And as I began doing that research, and evolutionary ethics is there are a couple of interrelated ideas that are tied into evolutionary ethics. One is that morality has evolved, and evolutionists were trying to then give explanations for how morality evolved. But then also there was a second component that sort of piggybacked onto that, which was the idea that the evolutionary process itself was morally good. And this is an idea that was going to be picked up by a lot of thinkers in the late 19th and early 20th century. Darwin himself, in fact, implies this a lot of times by talking about progress and using terms that have connotations of better and such when he talks about organisms. Even though sometimes he recognized that progress wasn't necessarily built into his theory, nonetheless, he still uses that terminology a great deal in The Origin of Species and also in The Descent of Man, if you look at it. So as I was doing my research on evolutionary ethics, I began to discover that, especially by the early 20th century, the first couple decades of the 20th century, that a lot of the people who were talking about evolutionary ethics were people who were involved in the eugenics movement, which was the movement to try to improve human heredity. Of course, eugenicists became very notorious for their campaigns to do compulsory sterilization and other kinds of things to try to improve humanity. Well, the other issue that I found out as I began exploring evolutionary ethics was that there were certain people around today who were using Darwinism to promote particular views of bioethics, and specifically people like Peter Singer, mm-hmm. The famous bioethicist at Princeton, right. Who believed that Darwinism undermined the Judeo-Christian sanctity of life ethic. And then as I began investigating these issues of eugenics and euthanasia, I started seeing a lot of connections between evolutionary ethics and Nazism. And I hadn't even originally, in my original research thinking, I hadn't even thought about Hitler or Nazism. But as I began doing the investigation and finding out about the impacts of Darwinism on social thought in the late 19th century, became sort of an inescapable connection. And it's not that I was the first person to make those connections. There were a lot of other historians who talked about social Darwinism in Nazi thought. So that wasn't sort of a totally new or unique idea, but it's not one that I was really originally looking for when I started my research. Mm. From Darwin to Hitler, then, looked at how evolutionary ethics undermined, at least in the minds of some thinkers, and again, I don't say that everyone bought into this. My argument is much more nuanced than that, although some critics have claimed that it isn't. My argument is that there were many prominent thinkers, biologists, medical professors, people involved in the eugenics movement, who used Darwinism to undermine the Judeo-Christian sanctity of life ethic, and so they began promoting things like euthanasia, killing disabled infants, infanticide, and such, and also racial extermination. That was also very prominent because of their racist ideas. That then fed into Nazi thinking that produced a lot of the more abominable aspects of Nazism, or at least aided in those things. I'm not claiming it was the sole source of it, and that's another place that many of my critics have got me wrong. They have said that I'm claiming that Darwinism was the only thing causing Nazism, which is, of course, nonsense, because there were many different ideology that fed into Nazism. But I'm
arguing that this is one of the major streams of that contributed to this thought, or how would you put
that? Yes, I would say that. I would say it's a very major aspect of it, but it's not the only one. There were other elements, nationalism, anti-Semitism, other things that fed into the stream. But Darwinism was a very important one. It actually was the one that sort of helped to integrate some of the other components into a sort of coherent worldview.
Is it just Hitler's thought that you're looking at, or is it more the sort of philosophy of National Socialism of the Nazi Party in general? Is it both?
Well, it's sort of both. Although in the new book that's coming out in July on Hitler's ethic, I do focus mostly on Hitler. Spend a little bit of, I don't really talk about many of the other Nazi thinkers. I sort of keep it tightly focused on Hitler. I do talk about some of the people who influenced him to some degree, but a lot of that's already covered in From Darwin to Hitler in more detail.
Mm-hmm.
But I do talk about it a little bit and bring it up at appropriate points. So, for example, when I talk about Hitler's promotion of euthanasia, or killing of the disabled, I do talk about the fact that Ernst Haeckel, the leading Darwinist in Germany in the late 19th century, was the first German thinker to seriously propose killing the disabled. And first he talked about killing the disabled infants in 1870, mm-hmm. his book The Natural History of Creation, and then in 1904 he went ahead and proposed killing disabled adults as well, based on physicians, commissions of physicians. And this is sort of the way the Nazis proceeded. They had these physicians' commissions. They actually had a lawyer on the commissions, too, who determined whether to kill a certain disabled people.
Mm-hmm.
So I do talk about some of the thinkers that influenced the Nazis, including, and many of them were leading anthropologists, leading medical professors and such in the pre-Nazi period.
And in Hitler's Ethic, the new book, you seem to argue that Hitler had a coherent ethic, and I'd like to touch on this, you know, because some people dismiss Hitler as mentally unstable just because of his, you know, extremely repugnant views and actions. So what reasons are there for thinking that he had a coherent ethic?
Well, yeah, it's interesting that among the sort of popular views of Hitler, there is this notion that Hitler was crazy, insane. However, interestingly, most historians have come around to the idea in the last couple of decades that Hitler did have a coherent worldview.
Hmm.
Eberhard Jaeckel, back in the early 70s, wrote a book called Hitler's Worldview, in which he promoted the idea that Hitler had a coherent worldview. And even people who promote a sort of structuralist view of history, which is sort of focusing more on economic and social forces rather than ideology. Even many of them have come around to the idea that Hitler had a coherent worldview. Ian Kershaw, who's the leading biographer of Hitler, he has a two-volume scholarly biography of Hitler out, and so he's really the leading authority on Hitler in the world today. Kershaw, in his book, even though he himself was a structuralist and still is a structuralist in many ways, still does think that Hitler had a coherent worldview. So the idea that I'm promoting that Hitler had a coherent worldview is pretty accepted in amongst scholarly historians. Not all of them have explored it in exactly the same way I have, and maybe all of them aren't going to be totally pleased. We'll have to see how the book gets received in that respect. But the idea that he had a coherent worldview is actually pretty widely received. Now, the idea that he had a coherent ethic, though, is taking things a little step further, maybe, than Kershaw and Jaeckel have taken, because they didn't really explore his moral views in any depth. However, Richard Evans, who's also one of the more prominent historians covering the Nazi era these days, he just published a three-volume book on the Nazi period. He also does believe that Hitler had a coherent ethic. He doesn't use that word coherent ethic, but he does talk in one place about him having a scientific ethic and such. And he also agrees that Hitler was very heavily influenced by social Darwinism.
Hmm. And when you say Hitler was inspired by evolutionary ethics, what do you mean by evolutionary ethics? And I ask this because biologists, you know, like Richard Dawkins, and in that large camp, you know, they tend to say that, well, you know, Darwinism implies has certain ethical consequences, or implies a certain ethic, and we should rebel against it. Well, there seems like there's others out there, maybe E.O. Wilson and others, who think that evolution, Darwinian evolution, means that we should, you know, care for the animals more or something like that. And so how do we decide what evolutionary ethics really is?
Well, one of the aspects of evolutionary ethics is the idea that ethics itself evolved, that it's not, that there is no sort of fixed morality out there somewhere that's objective and fixed. And so once you believe that morality has evolved over time, and this is one of the things that I think is most dangerous about it, it sort of cuts ethics free from any kind of objectivity. So you're only left with whatever instincts or rationality or a combination of those two things that you have in trying to determine what is good or what is bad. There really is no good or bad other than just whatever benefits the species in the long term. And you can't know that. So my actions today, I can't know what's going to benefit necessarily the species in the future. So you're sort of left with this conundrum ethically. And also, who's to say, if you buy into those views, who's to say that Hitler's morality was any worse than anyone else's? If he's acting according to his instincts that tell him, in fact, this is what he said. He said that his instincts tell him that he should favor the Aryans. He should favor the German race. If his instincts tell him that, then how is what he is doing morally bad? Well, I suppose you could say, well, he lost the war, so I guess, you know, that's the only thing bad about it, I suppose. But in sort of an objective sense, there's nothing morally bad about it. In fact, I was giving a seminar one time here at my university, and I had two students. We were reading the book by James Rachels called Created from Animals, The Moral Implications of Darwinism, where he argues that Darwinism undermines the Judeo-Christian sanctity of life ethic. And two of the students in that seminar told me that Hitler was neither good nor bad.
Wow.
And they based it on their understanding that morality had evolved, and so there was no fixed standard of morality anywhere. And so that becomes one of the more dangerous, in my opinion, views that link to this idea that morality has evolved, that there's no... Now, because there's all sorts of other kinds of moral relativism that aren't necessarily based on Darwinism. I'm not saying that all moral relativism goes back to Darwin, but certainly Darwinian accounts of morality, as in Darwin's own Descent of Man, certainly do relativize morality. But then there's a second issue relating to the evolutionary ethics, and that is the idea that the evolutionary process itself defines what is good. And Hitler certainly believed that, and he thought that by trying to drive human evolution forward, by favoring what he thought was the best humans, in other words, getting rid of the so-called inferior peoples, such as the disabled, and what he thought of as inferior races, by getting rid of them, he thought that he was actually improving and elevating the human species, and that this then was morally good. And not only that, but he thought that the Germans had the highest form of morality around, and so by getting rid of the so-called immoral, and he thought of these as being biologically immoral, that there was a biological traits, by getting rid of the biologically immoral Jews, he thought he was actually improving morality on the whole, that the world would get more moral as the noble Germans who were hardworking and diligent and truthful and, you know, put all the good positive moral traits there for the Germans, that it, promoting them would actually improve things morally around the globe.
Now, I wanted to touch on... six things that I think you mentioned in the book, different aspects of this evolutionary ethic and or ways this played out in Nazi Germany, and I'm hoping you could help connect them to this evolutionary ethic, these different parts of, say, the Nazi program, if you will. And one that you just mentioned was racial extermination. I think you mentioned why that might be, in a sense, good for the species in this sort of perverted logic. But what about offensive warfare? I mean, how do they derive something like that from this evolutionary ethic?
Well, there was a Darwinian biologist who became a geographer named Friedrich Ratzel in late 19th century Germany, who formulated an idea known as living space, or in the German as Lebensraum. And the idea was that as species multiply beyond what their food supply can sustain, that's an idea that's in Darwinian theory that was brought into it from Malthus's population ideas in the early 19th century, that as these populations expand faster than their food supply, they have to expand in their space, and they'll come into competition with other species or other races within their species in the spaces around them. And so there's this fight for living space. And so offensive warfare, many social Darwinists in the late 19th and early 20th century Germany argued that offensive warfare was just a part of the struggle for living space. It was part of the struggle for existence, the Darwinian struggle for existence. And so they justified it then as being good for the species because it got rid of the, it let the superior ones take over the land and then multiply more prolifically than the so-called inferior ones. wins. Whoever loses is the unfit or inferior ones. And so the offensive warfare by the Nazis was construed as part of gaining living space. And Hitler uses this terminology consistently. And if you read any history of Nazi Germany, they talk about the ideology of living space and the pushing for living space. A lot of them don't necessarily understand the Darwinian roots of that, but that is where it came from.
That makes a lot of sense. In that sort of warped view, but what about something harder like racism? Was the racism just sort of already present, and this was a new excuse to be racist towards Jewish people, or is there something closer in the logic that sort of entails a certain sort of racism?
Well, racism, of course, predated Darwin by many centuries, and so Darwinism didn't create racism by any stretch of the imagination. However, Darwin did integrate racism into his theory. If you read The Descent of Man, he sees races as being evolved at different levels or different in different ways, so that some had evolved further from, the last common ancestor than other races. And so he does talk about there being superior and inferior races, and they see this as being part of the evolutionary process. So they weren't just, humans weren't just all, say according to the more traditional Judeo-Christian view of the pre-19th century, humans weren't created with one ancestor that then gave birth to all the different races. Rather, they had come from some common ancestor that then had diverged and evolved in different ways. And so the focus was on inequality, because to get evolution off the ground, you have to have variability. And so Darwin, and even more so many other Darwinists like Ernst Haeckel in Germany, and Germans were even more racist in some respects, the German Darwinists, than say Darwin was, but Darwin was too. Haeckel saw different human races as being separate species. In fact, Haeckel even said that there was four different genera of humans. So the idea was that they wanted to show as much divergence as possible within humans to show that evolution is happening among humans now too. So there are ways in which racism actually helped to legitimate Darwinian theory, especially in relation to humans, human evolution. The Nazis, and this is a very interesting point because a lot of people don't understand this, even many German historians don't understand that the Nazis certainly believed in human evolution. They did not think that the Aryan race had sprung, by itself, at some point in time, had been specially created or something like that. They did believe that it evolved, and that they believed that it evolved into a higher level than many other human races, and they thought that the reason that the Nordic, they very often call it the Nordic race, Aryan and Nordic were considered synonymous in many respects by the Nazis. They thought that the Nordic race, the reason that it had evolved higher was because of the harsh elements, the harsh Nordic climate that it had to endure, and because of the ice ages and such. And so they thought that this harsh climate had promoted a very strong struggle for existence that had weeded out the inferior ones and left only the real hardy, strong individuals. So they had an evolutionary explanation for the racial inequality that was a very important part of their racial theory. Now, that said, obviously there are many other elements of racism, anti-Semitism in particular, and many of the stereotypes that went with it that had no Darwinian origins at all, but they were also integrated into this Darwinian idea of a racial struggle for existence.
I remember watching some of the propaganda videos when they had that deadly medicine exhibit here at the Holocaust Museum in D.C.
Right.
And, the language of natural selection was everywhere, all over the eugenic program. I'm wondering if you could touch on specifically, because, the idea of, the eugenics, I think we can all see kind of how that stems from Darwinian theory. But what specifically about euthanasia? How does that fit into sort of this coherent ethic?
Well, euthanasia was just a more advanced, or I should say a more radicalized form of eugenics. Eugenics was the idea that you need to breed better humans, by promoting those that were considered superior and provide ways, get them to reproduce as prolifically as possible, and then by stopping the reproduction of those that were considered less fit or inferior. euthanasia was simply killing those people called inferior, rather than just compulsorily sterilizing them, which the Nazis already did in 1933, or they actually began the program in 34. They passed the law in 33, began it in 34. They compulsorily sterilized people, but then in 1939, they actually began killing those disabled people. But the purpose was the same. The purpose was to improve the human species. The purpose was to help evolution along, to evolve a better human species.
Well, that's about all the time we have for today. Thank you, Dr. Wecker, for being on the show to discuss your new book, Hitler's Ethic, The Nazi Pursuit of Evolutionary Progress, with us today. And once again, that's with Palgrave Macmillan. It is an academic book, so I take it will be probably fairly expensive. But we do hope that if you're interested, you will go out and get that. And for those who haven't read From Darwin to Hitler, I highly recommend it. It is out in a paperback now and much less expensive. And so I think you will find that it is carefully argued and well-researched, and I believe had over 800 footnotes. So thanks so much again for being on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
You bet. This is Logan Gage for another episode of ID the Future. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.